Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a man who's injected himself with snake venom hundreds of times, and a tour of London architecture that goes off the rails, or rather, the river. But first, we begin today with the latest installment of our Culture Cap, where we explore a defining element of life here in the Valley. Today, we bring you Culture Cap Throwing Shade Edition. And this is actually the kickoff of a series we're going to bring you all summer long here on the show, conversations about why shade is such a precious resource here in the Valley and why it's so hard to create it. Joining me this morning for a deep dive on shade is Richard Adkins, the City of Tempe's urban forester. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
I'm also joined by the director of the Shade Lab at ASU, Ariana Medell. Ariana, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Ariana, let's start with you. We've had a lot of conversations here on the show about the importance of things like cooling centers in the summer, making water more available. But let's talk about the importance of shade physiologically. Why is shade so important?
Shade is really important here in the Valley because we have a very hot and dry climate. So the major component of the heat load your body experiences outdoors actually comes from the direct sunlight. So as heat sources, we have the shortwave radiation, that's the direct sunlight, the visible light, and the UV radiation, and then the longwave radiation, which is the heat that comes off of hot surfaces. So when you're standing on a parking lot, the heat radiates at you. But the direct sunlight is the major component of that heat load.
So we're sort of the meat in a heat sandwich
exactly.
In that scenario. Richard, I learned a fact recently that I was very fascinated about. I'd love to hear more about it from you, which is that about 100 years ago, maybe more, Phoenix was actually known as the Valley of Gardens and Trees. Is this true?
That is true. I mean, affectionately, we're known now as the Valley of the Sun. But around the turn of the century in the early 1900s, Phoenix was referred to as the Valley of Gardens and Trees. You can find a lot of historic photos showing vegetation fields, vegetable fields, and fruit orchards all around Camelback Mountain.
So obviously that is, as you were just pointing out, not the way we characterize ourselves these days. What changed? Where did all the trees and orchards go?
Well, people started coming to the Valley of the Sun. I mean, the population changed here in Phoenix area between 1940, where it was below 100,000 people, to 1960, when it was over 400,000 people. So you had the input of people coming and then development, the advent of air conditioning that became commercially available to the average homeowner. And then in the 70s, I mean, really started for infrastructural development here in the Valley. The canals went underground, the streets got wider, the trees that were occupying those spaces disappeared.
And can I ask you a little bit about the cultural context there? I would have to imagine that the abundance of nice places to spend time outside would have also led people to congregate in different ways or at all.
Indeed. And a lot of time people were spent outside under the shade of the trees, and that was where the community was built. And so like when the air conditioning came about, people kind of went inside in that community of the environment was kind of lost.
Yeah. So, Ariana, obviously, one of the results of this development and air conditioning and things like that is that trees were once upon a time not just an abundant source of shade, but sort of the only real significant source of it. But now, by dint of development and expansion, as Richard was just saying, that's obviously a much more complicated picture. And a few years ago, you did a study about this. Tell us what you found.
Yes. So we conducted a study called 50 Grades of Shade, where we were interested in the effectiveness of different shade types. Because obviously we love trees and we would like to plant more trees, but there are a lot of infrastructure challenges in urban environments. So there are sewer lines underground, power lines. So there are a lot of places where you can't plant trees. So we were interested in finding if there are other alternative shade types. And we used an instrument called MARTI. MARTI stands for MRT because it measures the heat load of the human body, which is MRT. And MARTI looks a little bit like WALL-E. So it has these sensors that are called net radiometers, and they have like these white circles. Uh-huh. And so we've taken MARTI out onto the streets and parks to measure different types of shade, anything from shade from buildings, pergolas, umbrellas, shade sails, different types of trees. And it turned out that engineered shade is actually quite effective.
Okay. And any particular types of engineered shade? Or first I should ask, when you say engineered shade, what kinds of structures are you referring to?
Yeah, so this could be anything from a shade sail you put up in your backyard to a pergola or canopy. It could be an umbrella that you bring when mm-hmm. you walk outside. So the most effective shade came actually from buildings because it's a very solid, very dense type of shade. But that's only true during the day because buildings, they heat up during the day when the sun hits the facade, and then at night they release the heat back into the atmosphere. But during the day, they really provide a lot of relief from the heat.
Okay. Well, so obviously it sounds like there are a lot of non-tree opportunities to create some additional shade. But Richard, I know you're overseeing a number of initiatives to try to improve the urban canopy so that we're kind of leveraging all of these solutions. One of the things I was interested in reading about your work, Richard, is that you've actually studied trees all over the world, Virginia, New Zealand, Nepal, obviously right here in the Valley. Much like not all shade is created equal, not all trees are either.
Indeed.
What are the unique elements of the tree species that we have here, and what can they offer?
Well, there's just such a variety of trees that we can grow here that actually do well. And a lot of people want to use all native species, which I think is great because they've evolved here in this climate. They're very low water use. But they also have different attributes that we have to be aware of, like spines and thorns and prickles. We can't put that next to a soccer field or a play field or next to a parking meter, per se. So we really got to be intelligent in our design when we're looking at different species to plant.
Ariane, is there a difference physiologically between the impacts, the benefits of shade that's created by a tree and something like a pergola or the shade of a building?
In the end, it's all driven by the amount of solar radiation or direct sunlight that hits your body. So if you have a tree with a low leaf area density, like maybe tiny leaves that let through a lot of sunlight, that shade would be less performant than a denser shade, let's say from a ficus tree, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially driven by the amount of direct sunlight that hits your body.
I see. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about this, these environmental questions that you were just kind of alluding to, Richard, and how the placement of the trees, and I have to imagine the specific type of tree, are really important when we're looking at this. Let's talk about the infrastructure concerns, because it's some people might be hearing this and thinking, like, you know, what's so hard about just planting more trees? Why is that controversial? but tell us a little bit, Richard, about why that it's not as easy as it sounds.
Well, it's basically a matter of space. And we look at soil budgets when you're trying to put a tree in a dense urban environment. And it's got to have space for the roots to really expand and grow for the tree to reach its genetic potential. And some of those areas are just not available in some of our developing areas. That's where the engineered shade actually makes a very good alternative in certain areas.
Are there similar infrastructural challenges to engineered shade?
Yes. There's an example for I was talking to someone from the city of Tempe. It's a while ago, and I think it was Bonnie Richardson, and we were wondering why there's no shade along Tempe Town Lake. either trees or engineered shade.
Oh yeah,
and there
now
is
that you
a
point that out. There is no shade on Tempe Town Lake.
There is no shade, but the problem is that there is a support structure for the lake that prevents anything to be built very close to the lake. Mm-hmm. And so there are challenges with engineered shade structures as well.
So one of the other things that the specificity of that Tempe Town Lake example brings to mind for me, Ariana, is that I know you've done a lot of work on heat mapping and the ways that heat and sunlight are present and particularly intense or less intense in various parts of the city. Talk about how you put those maps together and why they're important.
We use a model called Solvay to create these heat maps, and these heat maps show the mean radiant temperature, which is the heat load on your body at a very high resolution, 1 meter resolution. And we have these maps for all of the Phoenix metropolitan areas. And these maps can be used to figure out where are the hot spots in the valley. There are definitely parts of the valley that have less shade than others, and it could be either shade from buildings or trees, doesn't matter. So those maps can be used to make decisions on what are the priority areas to plant more trees or provide more shade in general.
I have to imagine that there are some areas where an engineered solution might work better than a tree solution, right?
Yes. If you look at these parking lots, they're usually pretty harsh environments for trees. So you might think about putting up solar panels because they shade cars as well as or maybe even better than trees, and they have a higher survival rate.
All right. Well, we have lots more to talk about here on the Shade edition of the Culture Cap. We will be right back. Good morning and welcome back to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. I'm here with the City of Tempe's urban forester, Richard Adkins, and the director of the Shade Lab at ASU, Ariana Medell. We're talking about shade and why it matters. And in that vein, I wanted to talk a little bit about the urgency of this, because so far we've been kind of looking at shade from a theoretical standpoint. But I think it's also really important to talk about, from a practical standpoint, why this matters so much. Our average summer temperature in the Valley, as everybody listening to this knows, is in the 100s. That's the average temperature. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year, I spoke to a postdoctoral researcher at USC named Eunyoung Choi. Her research suggests that heat here in the Valley doesn't just create like momentary crises, like heat stroke, exhaustion, dehydration. This research actually suggests that living in extreme heat is aging our cells significantly faster, 14 months faster, to be exact. Now, obviously, this is just one study, but that was stunning to me. And Ariana, I know you've done some work looking at the phenomenon of heat's impact on the body, right?
Yeah, I mean, heat affects everyone here in the Valley. It's not just, I mean, people die from it, but everybody is subject to heat stress, essentially, when you're outdoors, walking, waiting at the bus stop for your next connection. So what happens is, because it's such a dry heat, you need to really be hydrated a lot to keep your body going. And you're sweating a lot. So it's really, really important to keep yourself shaded in the summer when it's above, well, even when it's above 90.
Yeah. And, you know, as tempting as it is, Richard, you were alluding to the phenomenon of, you know, how pervasive air conditioning is in the Valley to accommodate our ever-expanding population. As tempting as it is when it gets really hot to go inside and just escape the heat, I know that for you, being out in nature is really important and cultivating, as I understand it, kind of a personal relationship with not just shade, but trees in general. Can you talk a little bit about this? I know you're a proponent of something called forest bathing.
Oh, indeed. Trees, good shade, physiological shade, of course, is quite important for our standard health, but also our mental health as well. That's a lot of the benefits of urban forests that people do not really realize. And so, I mean, it is warm and we kind of acclimatize as we go through the summer, but You can see about August and September here in the valley, people's mental acuity seems to start to go down, and people, you know, tempers get a little bit quicker.
Sure.
But now being able to get out and have a better standard of life, quality of life with green spaces and being able to go out and experience trees and plants really does help one's mental health.
Can I ask you what that looks like, just to speak from your own experience? Like, if somebody is hearing that and thinking, I don't know how to start, like, should I just go and stand next to a tree? I realize this probably sounds a little simplistic, but how do you approach that when you're trying to kind of reestablish your own connection from a mental health standpoint?
I think standing next to a tree is actually a good start.
Okay.
But a grove of trees, even. It could be in your backyard, in your local neighborhood park. Sometimes if you want to drive into one of our preserve areas here in the valley or out on South Mountain Park, or even if you need to go up north perhaps to get up on the rim and get more into our ponderosa forest. It's just more of your own personal approach as you go into the forest. It's welcoming you and you're welcoming it, so it's more of a very experiential type tactile thing. You need to touch the trees, feel the soil, and just kind of experience the wind blowing, the animals, the birds. I know it sounds very esoteric, but it really does open up one's mind and really see the forest for the trees.
Ariana, has this come up in your research at all? I know in one of the studies that you did, I saw a stat that was something like the body temperature can go down by as much as 30% by spending time in shade. That's pretty significant. Have you looked at all at the psychological impacts that this has on folks?
I've not done any studies personally here in Phoenix on the psychological impacts, but I've read in the literature that trees have a lot of other benefits, especially to your mental health as well. There's a study that was conducted in a hospital, the researchers looked at patients in beds that were facing the parking lot versus facing a forest area or, you know, a park. And those patients healed much quicker than the patients that were facing the parking lot. So there is a huge mental health benefit that trees offer that engineered shade would not.
Well, so we've been talking about kind of the softer side of trees. Let's talk about some of the really concrete efforts that the Valley is making to increase the number of trees that we have available to us. Richard, one of the initiatives related to this is something called tree equity. And Phoenix has made a very aggressive commitment to tree equity, trying to reach this standard known as tree equity by 2030. Tell us what tree equity means and how are you working on that here in Tempe?
All right. Well, there's a number of cities within the valley that are focusing on that. And Tempe, of course, is one. Well, the whole thing is equity, as we mentioned earlier, not all parts of a city are shaded equally. Due to some past history or development, anywhere within our census tracts that shade ranges from 25% in some neighborhoods down to 5 and 6% on other neighborhoods or, you know, development parks. So the whole thing is trying to bring that average up and provide everybody an equal opportunity to have shade and experience the benefits that trees provide.
So within that, you launched something called the Urban Forestry Master Plan back in 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
That was the city adopted it in 2017.
City adopted it. Okay. The goals contained within that's for Tempe specifically, correct?
Correct.
The goals are very ambitious. Tell us what the benchmarks that Tempe's working towards are.
Right now, we are looking at updating our Urban Forestry Master Plan, but right now the benchmark is measured at 25%, and we're sitting at 14.5%, one of the highest shaded cities here in the valley.
Okay. And the goal was 25% by
2040.
By 2040. Okay. So a good portion of the way there. One of the interesting, you know, we were talking a moment ago about the broader impacts of something like trees.
One of the things that was interesting to me about the Urban Forestry Master Plan is it's part of a larger initiative, if I'm not mistaken, to make Tempe something called a 20-minute city.
Yes.
Tell us what a 20-minute city is.
Well, a 20-minute city is being able from your home within 20 minutes to provide, get to all the whatever you need, mm-hmm. whether it be shopping, whether it be school, whether it be to work, and be able to do that comfortably. Perhaps be in a shaded corridor, but to be able to comfortably get anywhere within the city within 20 minutes.
So the idea there is that shade is a big part of that because it makes the city, I guess, more walkable?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Okay, which I would imagine would also encourage things like construction of like neighborhood shops.
Exactly, and being able to go from, say, a shade node to a shade node. There might be some areas where there's, you know, no shade or you have some more solar radiation, but you'd be able to go from area to area within a short amount of time.
Okay. Ariana, let me ask you, you know, beyond trees, as you look around the city, where do you see, just from your own opinion, having done all the research you've done, where do you see opportunities to create more shade, innovative solutions, things we could be taking advantage of that we're not currently?
We have a lot of impervious surfaces here, a lot of parking lots. We put so many parking lots next to our shopping malls that Black Friday can be accommodated, but the rest of the year, they're essentially empty. So those parking lots have an extensive surface and definitely need more shade. So it would be a lot of opportunities to put solar panels on these parking lots that produce electricity at the same time. So if you have PV cells that produce electricity and then at the same time shade those cars. So that would be one option because we have so much solar radiation here. It's a missed opportunity.
Richard, same question.
I'm going to say same answer.
Okay.
We have recently measured all of the impervious areas, surfaces here in the city of Tempe, and being able to reduce those or either have some kind of perhaps a management fee for having large parking lots because you have a lot of stormwater runoff from all of those whenever it does rain. So that's another thing that we need to look at, and we can capture some of that water to help water and grow trees in some of those areas.
We've got just about a minute left here. I'm curious if either of you have a favorite shady spot you'd like to recommend, either in Tempe or just around the city.
There's a really, really nice large ficus tree next to the Memorial Union on ASU's campus. Okay. I really like that tree.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's some areas in the Tempe Preserve. It's called Lo Piano. It's right off the side of the freeway. It's very nice. Lots of mesquite trees down there. It's a very pleasant place to go.
Okay. So maybe some aromatics to go with
Indeed.
Your shade. All right. Well, I've been talking about shade with Ariana Medell, the director of ASU's Shade Lab, and Richard Adkins, the City of Tempe's urban forester. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, would you let a venomous snake bite you?
It's basically like a bee sting. But the difference is a bee sting only has like 1 or 2 milligrams, and snakes can have upwards of 400 to 500 milligrams, sometimes more.
We will hear from a man who's been bitten over 200 times for the sake of science. But first, after 27 years as the director of Arizona's Commission for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, Sherry Collins retired late last year. But as that chapter ended, she recently started a new one as the executive director of a group called Deaf Seniors of America. Collins brings a unique perspective to her work supporting the deaf community. She has lobbied at the state legislature, worked as a mentor and board member for a wide range of organizations serving people with disabilities. But as she puts it, when she goes home at night, she's also a deaf person trying to navigate the world. Collins was born deaf. And though she now has some hearing thanks to a cochlear implant, she made her way through much of her life thanks to lip reading and American Sign Language. Her combination of experiences gives her strong feelings about how to make the world a more welcoming place. When we spoke recently, she told me Arizona has a long way to go.
As a person who is in the early stage of their retirement, our population of for older adult is pretty large in Arizona, obviously, mm-hmm. because it's a great place to retire. But services for the deaf senior citizen is significantly poor. We have a lot of work to do. Like, for example, go to a nursing home. Where can we go that is accessible for us? There's not one.
In the entire state?
Not one.
That specializes in services for deaf people?
Correct. Not one.
Wow.
So can you imagine if I need to go into a home, all these people that live there, I will be isolated. My health, quality of life will go down very quickly.
Right. That sense of feeling isolated and alone is very hard when you're young. I can imagine it being extra difficult when you're older.
Right. And, you know, so now here I am in my golden chapter of my life. I worry about my future. You know, do I want to stay in Arizona? I don't know. Those are the things that I think about because I don't have children of my own. If I don't have kids, I'm going to have to rely on the system and resources for me.
Right.
And that's scary.
Right. Another thing I have to imagine has changed tremendously over the course of your life doing this work is the culture around deafness, both between deaf people and hearing people and amongst deaf people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What have been some of the big changes there?
That's like another show right here. But
do we need to extend this interview by an hour?
Well, you know, a lot. Okay, there has been a shift. The deaf culture still exists, but it seems like to us, it's getting smaller. The reason for that, because more and more kids, because of the advanced technology, are going mainstream, going to a public school. Not going to the school for the deaf.
And are they able to do that because they're able to get things like cochlear implants or hearing aids?
Well, that's where, and I'm going to be very honest, that's where we in the deaf community feel like the professionals, like audiologists or the pediatric doctors, they want the medical fixed. We don't. We're like, wait a minute. You know, it's not the quick fix. That look at that child. Why not expose that child with everything? Don't make a decision on fixing the ear. Let's learn. You say, okay, this child can benefit hearing aid. Fine. Then introduce language development, making sure they're reading lip. Not responding? Maybe you want to add some sign language. Why can't you have all of that? And that's where, you know, a lot of times the parents feel like they have to make a decision. Well, I want my child to be oral and not knowing sign language, and I'm going to get that ear fixed because it's convenient for them.
It's convenient for them, meaning the parents.
The parents. Because it's convenient for the parent because they can communicate. You know, and that's where we try to tell the family is that, you know, you don't have to make a decision right now. Just give your child everything.
So you're saying that as technology has expanded, that allows parents to address whatever specific issue may be preventing the child from hearing, from your perspective, the child may in gaining whatever they get from that technology, they may be losing something else.
Right. You know, we're not telling the parents, don't give your child an implant, but that's not the only solution. Because what happens is when that child grows up and they discover later, oh, there's deaf community, there's sign language, oh, I really like that. They take their implant off and they stop wearing them.
Wow.
We have seen that. It's just like, no, uh-huh. I like, this is my community. I like the ASL because I'm not isolated. I have friends that can socialize. So they feel this sense of place, of belonging.
Yes, yes.
And so I'll use myself an example. I got my one implant that I have in my right ear when I moved to Arizona, but I was an adult. I made that decision on my own.
And in your case, you made that decision having had a lifetime of learning sign language, learning to read lips, learning this whole range of resources that you were then adding the implant to. Whereas if your parents had had that option available when you were very young and had made that decision for you, you might not have reached adulthood with that range of resources.
That is correct. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I asked my parents when I was younger, they did test me for that. At that time, I did not meet the criteria because the technology of the implant wasn't ready for the type of hearing loss that I had. And I'm glad.
Yeah. I have to imagine, Sherry, that these types of conversations you're having with parents in particular must be very difficult because I can imagine a parent really wanting to give their kid what they see as this gift of saying, you don't have to have this experience, not thinking of the context that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach that delicate conversation?
Listen to them and just, you know, ask them, how are they doing? And if they're like, I don't know what to say, then I always say, you know, let me tell you my story. And I always come up front and say, you know, I am not here to try and change your mind. I want to make sure you are informed of all the resources available for you. I said, oftentimes the professionals are only giving you very limited information that they believe is the quick fix.
It's very striking to me that the first thing you said was that you would say to the parent, how are you doing?
Right.
Because I'm imagining they're entering into this conversation because they're thinking, in most cases, about their kid and how their kid is doing.
Right.
And by giving them space to talk about what it's like for them, you completely change the dynamics of that interaction.
Right.
I could imagine it also introducing the possibility that they might realize, I'm thinking about what I need. I'm not thinking about what my kid might ultimately need.
Right. So I think it's important to give them everything. Maybe their time is not that moment.
Well, Sherry Collins is the former director of the Arizona Commission for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing and the incoming executive director of Deaf Seniors of America. Sherry, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. More than 80,000 people globally die every year from snake bites, according to the World Health Organization. But our next guest is trying to bring that number down by using himself as a sort of test case. Tim Fritti is director of herpetology at CentiVax in San Francisco, a company that develops universal vaccines. And he has allowed himself to be bitten by snakes hundreds of times. He's also injected himself with snake venom in an attempt to build up antibodies that can be used to make antivenom. His case recently appeared in the journal Nature. Tim Fritti spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked what prompted him to be the guy who injects himself with snake venom and allows himself to be bitten by snakes.
Well, I'm not the only guy. The creator of what I do with self-immunization, which is called SI, is Bill Haast. And his first injection was 1948, and he has since passed. He made it to 100 and had a great life. And I had a chance to meet him back in 1999. And that kind of forever changed my life. He didn't teach me things specifically, but he was a big inspiration for me with making a human immune to snake bite and not use a horse.
Why is that so important to you? Like, what to you is the upside?
The upside is 125,000 people a year die. And I'm proud to represent humanity and give a little bit back and use my own body to be studied in a laboratory to make a better antivenom than we have now.
So for how long have you been doing this? When did you start?
I started in 2001, in March of 2001, and went all the way to 2018 in November, and then I retired from it. I pushed it really, really hard for a long time, and we didn't have funding back at that time.
Hmm.
So I funded myself for 18 years while raising a family, working construction, working in factories, being a pizza delivery driver, washing dishes, because I don't have a degree. So I had to take any job I could get. And unfortunately, it sucked. But while I was doing that during the day, I go to my lab at night and do all my stuff with my snake.
Well, so how did you actually know what to do?
I didn't, because there's no book or university that teaches you how to do this. There are books out there, but there's nothing specific on how many milligrams to inject, how often to do it, do I have high IgG titer levels? Those are unanswered questions. They were unanswered questions. They're not now, but you know, I just set out after I beat Snakebite and sat there. It was great. You know, I didn't have to die or use antivenom, although I did use antivenom once. I used 6 vials. And at that point, I just realized that, you know, how can I get this 8,000 miles away to where people die from Snakebite? And I basically represent people in the old world that are expendable.
So I want to clarify, because you have both been bitten by snakes and injected yourself with venom. How many times have you done each of those things?
200 bites and over 700 injections as of 2018. I did more after that, some bites and some injections, but just for my personal, just because I wanted to do it.
Where did you get the venom?
Well, I got the venom from people in Florida that bred snakes and they ship them to me. I also get dry venom from all over the place, too. I really don't need snakes to self-immunize. I have a freezer full of venom that's dried out, and I have enough venom in there to last me a lifetime.
That is not something I ever thought I'd hear a human being say. I have enough venom to last me a lifetime.
Yeah, I do. I do.
So take me back to 2001, the first time you did this. What was going through your mind?
Yeah, I was scared. You know, I diluted it down 1 in 10,000 times with the Egyptian cobra venom and Monaco cobra venom. And I started with that because they were dangerous. I could get them. And I didn't know what it was going to be like. Nobody told me what it was going to feel like. It's basically like a bee sting. But the difference is a bee sting only has like 1 or 2 milligrams. And snakes can have upwards of 400 to 500 milligrams, sometimes more. So it's not just qualitative, it's quantitative. And that's the big difference. And then I just realized that all these people are dying from snake bite, and what was going to be my next step, which was very hard to do.
So that first time, was that intentional, or were you just sort of out and about and you got bitten by a snake?
No, it was intentional.
It was, okay.
Yeah, original cobra bites were intentional. There's two on September 12th of 2001. About half a year after I started, I took 2 bites in an hour. It was stupid. My mind wasn't around it. Ended up in ICU in a coma for 4 days.
Wow.
And that's how I started out, is by failure. I didn't start by any success whatsoever. There's no way.
Do you foresee a time when people might no longer die from snake bites?
They're always going to die. Because we can't immunize all of them. They're not all going to get the antivenom. And there's such an antivenom shortage right now. I think just in Africa, they're making 15,000 vials a year of antivenom, and they need roughly 2 million.
Mm.
That's just Africa. Now, if you jump over to Asia, where 100,000 people a year die, then jump into India, where 50,000 people a year die, that's our marketplace. We want to start there.
Was there any point during, you know, the last couple of decades when you thought that you were not going to survive this project you were doing?
At least 12 times. Simply because, number one, it's painful. I was supporting myself and a family. A couple times I knew that, you know, I passed out after a couple bites and I'm like, oh man, I'm going down. I've had anaphylactic shock 12 times. So it's been a rough journey. And that's why a lot of people don't do it. Because you really, really have to be focused. I mean, you can't have a bad day. I mean, you know, I was dealing with death on a daily basis. And one of the reasons I was bitten so many times is I call it saddle time. The more you do it, the better you get at it. In my case, if you don't get good at it, you know, you're going to die. doesn't mean you have to get bit that many times, but my philosophy was the more I'm bitten, the easier it's going to be. And that's exactly how it was.
Have you ever been bitten by a snake when you weren't planning on being bitten by a snake?
Oh, yeah. I was bitten milking snakes. I've had them just crawl up my arm on a hook and bite me. Not all the time. Almost all my bites are self-induced. And I did that to prove a point that I can beat snake bite. Because back in the day, there were a lot of naysayers, which is fine. I love naysayers. That said I couldn't take a bite from a black mamba or a taipan or a cobra or a rattlesnake or a crate, you name it. And I did that. This will hopefully be the first time in 125 years since Albert Calmette, who basically created antivenom, that we could maybe change that to make a better product and to not use horses, but to use what we could make in a lab and mass produce it in the millions, antibody-wise. I sleep good at night knowing that, you know, I use my own body, put my life on the line for people that don't have a voice like I do.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you bet, Mark. It was a great time talking to you.
Tim Fritti is director of herpetology at the firm Centivax.
Evan Johnston is a finance major at ASU. This spring, he spent 6 weeks in England as part of his coursework, and one morning in early April, he had some free time, so he decided to do some touristy stuff. He signed up for a hop-on, hop-off bus tour.
It was supposed to go through all of the major landmarks in the central London, such as Big Ben, Buckingham Palace, the Tower of London, etc.
As I understand it, that is not what happened.
No, that's not what happened at all.
Things started to go sideways when Evan hopped off the bus and got on a boat, which was supposed to take him on a river cruise. But when he got onto this boat, something didn't feel right.
There was a bar and a lot of drinking happening.
Evan checked his watch. It was about 10 a.m. He scanned the bar area, and he noticed that it was all men, most of them wearing matching shirts. A few of them were singing a tribute to a town in Essex called Southend-on-Sea.
Eventually, I asked someone, like, am I on the right boat? Like, where is this headed?
And what did they tell you?
They broke the news to me that this was, in fact, heading to a soccer match.
Evan walked over to a security guard and told him he was on the wrong boat. But while Evan was explaining his situation, he was interrupted by a slightly red-faced man.
One of the soccer members came in and invited me to drink with them. So I obliged.
You did, okay. The man offered Evan a beer. Evan asked if they had any cider.
Because I can't drink beer. I'm gluten intolerant.
Don't worry, said the man. We'll take care of you. And they did.
Immediately, as soon as I joined them, I felt welcomed like I was part of their group already. And they started singing some chants like, Evan is a shrimper.
Shrimpers, they explained, is the unofficial nickname of Southend United, a football club based in Southend-on-Sea, the town they'd been singing about. The nickname is a tribute to the town's maritime legacy. There's a little picture of a shrimp on the team's logo. The Shrimpers were in the midst of a playoff run, and their fans were headed to an afternoon match. They demanded that Evan join them.
I could tell that it would make them really happy if I went, so I did.
A few ciders later, Evan and his fellow Shrimpers arrived at the match, where, much to Evan's surprise, an even bigger group of fans greeted him by name.
By this time, I had already been getting some fame on social media, and so some of the other fans that weren't on the boat that were kind of keeping up with the Southend news, they already knew who I was by this time.
They were thrilled to have a new Shrimper in their midst.
Yes. They started chanting USA.
In your honor?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
The chants continued throughout the match.
The one that sticks out the most to me is, Evan is a shrimper, Evan is a shrimper, la 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 la, la 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 la.
As for the team itself, they played pretty well, battling Sutton United to a 1-1 draw, keeping their playoff hopes alive.
Oh my gosh, the energy was just infectious. Like, the passion from all of the fans and the atmosphere was just incredible.
After the game, a group of shrimpers made sure Evan got back to his dorm safely. And since then, they've invited him to more matches. When Evan and I spoke, he was still trying to decide if he'd go.
To be determined. I have some weekend plans to go to France, actually.
But make no mistake, Evan has no regrets about missing his tour of Buckingham Palace that day.
I wouldn't have traded it for anything else.
As for Southend United, they'll face off against the Forest Green Rovers in the National League semifinals later today. Well, if I take anything from Evan's story, it's that if you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your day, just go do the first thing you think of, because you never know what it might lead to. And maybe, as we heard from Richard Adkins, all you need to do is go stand next to a tree. While you're out there, watch out for snakes. Thank you for listening to the show this morning. We'll be right back here tomorrow. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.